Now, let me tell you, one of the things that I can look back at in my radio career thus far, now entering its third decade, is the fact that I have gotten to interview so many really fascinating, interesting people. Not just a few presidents and all the Supreme Court justices and a bunch of senators and people who've made history, but also some of my favorites are investigative journalists who are keeping alive one of the most important traditions in the American story. And two of those journalists who have done some of the finest work that I can point to are Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. Their books include Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, and Crossing Zero, the AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire. And it is always a great privilege to welcome them to this program. Liz and Paul, are you with me?
We're here.
Thank you, glad to be back.
It's always a privilege to be with you.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I'm so glad you're here. We're going to, we might figure out how to turn you up a little bit, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm so glad you're here. So let me begin the conversation this hour. I want to ask you both to share your thoughts about the work of Dr. Michael Hudson. He's a Wall Street Journal financial analyst. He's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri. And you both recently sent me a link to an interview that he did about the FIRE industry, F-I-R-E, finance, insurance, and real estate, most of which is finance and Wall Street. And what has been happening in the last couple of decades in this country that has ramifications throughout our economics and our politics that most people aren't aware of and don't realize is happening right under their noses. What are the takeaways from his work and this interview that we can put a spotlight on for the listeners today?
Well, I think that what Dr. Hudson seems to be really excellent at is sort of, you know, first of all, he clearly establishes, I think, what I think was even in the article, his point about an average person can look at these situations and see that something is wrong the way things are going. And there's a lot of common sense involved in that experience. And, you know, and Dr. Hudson seems to have really put a very interesting spin on the problem. You know, he's actually identified that those who have gone into the education of to be educated about economics have been educated into a complete idiocy is basically what he's saying. So as he analyzes the way in which things are done, he is showing us how the very reverse of what they claim is going to happen happens. And that has a lot to do with the current economic crisis that we're seeing around the world. And we're also seeing in cities like Detroit, you know, would be one prime example of basically a bankrupt city. And how did it get bankrupt? And the way in which the International Monetary Fund functions and the World Bank and these entities, and at an American level, we have the equivalent of that through the various ways that finances are handled in terms of loaning money, how money is created, how interest is applied, and who pays for it all and who benefits from it. And he just makes it very clear. He simply explains the you know, the basics of how economics work. And when you hear it from that level, you realize that it really is quite simple. We really have individuals running things like the Fed and the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, you know, Goldman and Sachs. I mean, I think they'd certainly be a prime example of heavily influencing government policy in the United States, which ended up, for instance, you know, he could explain very easily why the quantitative movement moving money that was provided the banks after the 2007 crash actually enriched the banks, enriched Wall Street, and had nothing to do with helping the average person, many of whom had lost their homes because of the complete complete devastation in the real estate market. So this is one of the most important things, I think, that Dr. Hudson explains, is the way in which the banks have contributed to the crisis by creating a policy that basically really encouraged people to take on far more debt than they could handle. And that eventually the debt itself was then further sold, and the debt becomes basically the foundation of the economy. And that's pretty much what he has explained.
He also points out the perception that these things are the perception, not the reality, the perception that these things are mistakes, that these things that keep getting repeated again and again and again are mistakes. But yet the mistakes turn out to be exactly what this class of economists really are looking for. They're really looking for the fact that justification for the fact to go into a country like Greece and say, all right, so, oh, yeah, we made these terrible mistakes. We sold you all these lousy things that didn't pan out. You didn't make a lot of money on it. You developed industries that didn't work at our recommendation. So now you owe us all this money, and so you'll have to privatize all your national resources. You'll have to give us your water supply, which has been going around the world. You'll have to give us your railroads. You'll have to give us your airports. Your national airlines will now be our airlines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a process that's been going on for some time now. And I think it was pointed out in the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman that was published back in 2004, I believe. And it's basically the financial houses convinced these people. They sent people down into South America, into Africa, into third world countries, into Greece, into Southern Europe, and said, "Oh, look at you! We'll loan you the money." To do all these different things, to develop these industries or to advance these things, knowing full well at Goldman Sachs and some of these other financial houses that these countries would never be able to pay back the loans. And this was knowingly done. And so, you know, we're now living at the end of this financialization period where, I mean, financialization's been going on for thousands of years, and Michael Hudson points that out in his piece, Coy. He points out that, you know, in Samaria, you had this whole process of using grain as a background for supporting the financial economy, grain instead of gold, as an example. But the fact is that because it was a negotiable security, you knew you were going to get paid as soon as the harvest came in. You were going to be able to pay off all the commodities that you were using during the previous year. But so this has always been going on. But the fact is that we've reached this stage at the end of this financialization process, whereby the only thing that financialization does is more financialization. It doesn't produce anything. So our capitalist economy really is no longer a capitalist economy. The capital isn't being used to build new factories, to create jobs for the workers that work in the factories. Henry Ford, you know, paying his workers $5 a day so they could buy the Fords that came off the assembly line. You know, it was a pretty straightforward operation of cause and effect. You don't get that now. What you get is this financialized speculation with the rentier class, the money, the banks are loaning the money to real estate developers who then, you know, proceed to create rental apartments, which you therefore have to pay interest on for the loan to buy the rental apartment, et cetera, and on and on, without creating the basically hard-working jobs that you need in order to make the economy healthy.
And so the money that's moving is just money that's going towards debt service at the personal level, at the micro and the macro level.
Right, but I think his point was very specific, though, to point out it's the rentier class that people need to understand. People who basically make their money off of assets, they do not make it off of something that is actually productive. And that is a critical piece of understanding how the economy has been really changed from a capitalist, the ideals of the capitalist economy, where you basically have the state producing all the basic infrastructure, basically at interest-free, because the fact is that the state really prints its own money. And if we didn't have a Fed that was basically, that really is effectively a private corporation that prints money at a cost to the United States, we could actually have interest-free money starting from the government creating jobs through the whole development of the infrastructure. And that's the foundation of the ideals of capitalism. So that's the role the state was supposed to play. And what's happened is in the 19th century, the state played that role into the 20th century. But as we went through World War I and II, that's where it all changed. And the whole idea of this rentier class, which is, it's far easier to make a lot more money basically on rent, effectively, and it, of course, it's the insurance, it's the financialization and insurance industry and the real estate. All these together are the basis of the idea of an asset class, where there really is nothing made, there's nothing produced. So that becomes very attractive, and apparently the banks are well aware of that. So they have really gravitated, and that happened over, you know, like a 100-year period of time, where the banks shifted from basically helping to finance production and industry to basically, you know, turning more over into the rentier class. So that's an important shift, that now we are really at a point where many companies, and this is another point that was made, many companies, for instance, when they did receive the quantitative easing, let's say, they didn't go and create more jobs and more production capacity and try to develop more research to create better products. What they did is they bought back their own stock. So they were really paying off the stockholders and the bondholders, and absolutely it had little to do with producing more jobs and more products that people could then buy. So this is where now the economy begins to shrink. There is really no productive economy.
Which starts to get really scary. And as I was saying in the last hour, this is where revolutions come from. So what does this look like, Paul, in terms of politics? And I guess the most obvious thing is we see is we're not talking about this in political circles. We don't talk about this. Political candidates don't get up and talk about this stuff that is going on and how Wall Street financiers and this elite class of moneyed interests has hijacked a capitalist economy and changed it into something else entirely. And they have made the rent-seeking economics, which is pure corruption, they have made rent-seeking economics the whole MO for our governments, local, state, and federal. And they are there to serve the interests of a moneyed elite that makes money not from making things, but from debt service, from lending money to others.
It had to eventually wind up in the political system, because that's where the wash comes out. And that's what's going on with the Trump campaign right now. And it's I think if you look at both campaigns, they're both representatives of the status quo. Even though the Republican Party people are screaming about the fact that that Trump is the probable designated nominee, and the Democrats are just simply apoplectic over the fact that this guy should be making some of the statements he makes, and some of the statements, of course, that he makes are absolutely outrageous in terms of his positions. But the fact is that he has been absolutely consistent about certain things, and over the last 25, 30 years, if you actually go back and look at some of the positions that he's taken. So the fact is that I think the difference between Donald Trump and the traditional existing Republican and Democratic parties is that he comes from a different financial base. Now, remember, he comes from the rentier class.
Yeah, exactly.
He comes from the real estate developer class. He knows it very well. As he said recently, within the last couple of weeks, he knows debt very well. I think he's actually even gone bankrupt on a couple of occasions. And it doesn't bother him. He just comes back, puts the boxing gloves back on and goes to work again. So the fact is that, we have, as you mentioned, Coy, we do have some very, very core problems with what we refer to as the capitalist economy. You know, years ago, and after the 2008 collapse, there were some people in academia, some very high-level people, who actually said capitalism is over. Capitalism has actually ended as a functional economy or a means to create wealth. And so I think a lot of what we're seeing now is kind of a reversion to a pre 20th century industrial economy. We're going back to a much more feudal time in terms of real estate ownership and the rentier class, which ironically Both Marx and Engels in the 19th century viewed capitalism very positively. That's not the way they're played up, needless to say, and not in the modern American Western media as being pro-capitalist. But the fact was is that they saw capitalism in the creation of using capital to create industries and to create jobs and make a better life for the workers, for the working class. I mean, farming life, rural society was absolutely dire. It was awful. And when these factories opened up in New England and on the East Coast back in the 19th century, the early 19th century, you know, the farm girls flocked to these factories in Lawrence and Lowell and Haverhill, in Lynn, in New Bedford, along the eastern seaboard, because the farm life was absolute drudgery. 18 hours a day working from sun up till sundown, milking cows, plowing fields without machinery. I mean, you can't imagine what it was like. And so, you know, that's what they got out of. That's what America got out of. That's why America was the place to come to, because you could escape that kind of drudgery, whether it was a farm in Ireland or a farm in Bulgaria or a farm in Russia. It didn't make any difference. You could escape that kind of existence. And that's what we're going back to now. We're going back to a kind of almost like an indentured servitude. And this process is not new. This process has been going on for 30 years. I remember having a conversation with the father of a friend of ours from Swampscott, Massachusetts, and he was a teacher, a high school teacher, and he said, I remembered this conversation I had with him 35 years ago. He said, you know, he said something really strange is happening. He said, my students, he says, you know, we used to talk about democracy. We used to talk about, it was like instinctive. We all, you know, they all knew the Constitution. They all understood what the values we had in the Bill of Rights. And he said, the new class of kids that are coming in, he says, I don't know, it's because they're coming from other countries or whatever it is. He says, they don't know their basic rights. They don't understand the basic tenets of what this country was set up to do. And he said, it's almost as if we've got a peasant, they're absorbed with almost like a peasant mentality. Well, that was 35, 40 years ago. Now, that mentality, that peasant mentality, we confront all the time. We see it everywhere, this kind of sluggish, non-involved, backward, a lack of appreciation for the way in which you're being manipulated by the media, by your political class, by sloganeering, by some of the things that we see today. I mean, when I sit and watch some of these State Department press briefings on what's going on in the world, and the lack of actually aggressive questioning by the press corps, I mean, it really reminds me. I've watched a couple of these things over the last couple of years on Ukraine and Syria, and it almost struck me as a Saturday Night Live routine. And that's how disturbing it is.
And that's alive on the right and the left. This is no one party has a monopoly on what's happening here. We're seeing it across the spectrum.
No, in fact, I was just going to mention that I think that what really is coming out in this election is the sort of awakening at some primal level of a lot of that drudgery that Paul was just talking about. That there really is a kind of awareness that I'm being squeezed. I'm being stepped on. Something is happening. I'm beginning to react. But what we're also seeing is that, you know, people are coming out of this state in a state of ignorance, that there oftentimes is very little understanding. And, of course, the first thing they do is go out and look in the mainstream media. Well, as it turns out, that now is even being analyzed, and it's being shown that, you know, average Americans, a large percentage of average Americans, do not basically trust the mainstream media. So even though they may not know what the truth is yet, they instinctively know they're not being given something solid, substantive, that gives them a foundational way of understanding. And again, I would bring up Hudson's article and his focus on the instinctive level that the average person has about there's something wrong. I might not know the language to use to tell you, but I know something is wrong with this economy. It is basically not working for people. And I think that's where, of course, you get the appeal of a Bernie Sanders. I think the whole popularity that he really represents is the fact that there is a whole class of people. For instance, they say right now, they call them millennials, I guess is the term for it. A lot of the kids that have been saddled with huge student debt that they realize they'll probably never get out of unless the debt is totally relieved are completely aware of the fact that something is very wrong, that this is not, there's something fundamentally wrong with taking a young person and putting them into that situation where they realize they will have this debt probably for the rest of their lives.
And it's come full circle too, Coy. I mean, you can't, these kids have got so much college debt, they can't get out from under that debt in order to buy into the real estate market.
Right.
So to get more debt,
it's come full circle. They've destroyed their, you know, the rentier society has destroyed its own future.
But there is another aspect to this that cannot be underestimated, and that has to do with some of the agendas that are playing in to actually really undermine the sovereignty of basically the United States. It's not just the United States, it's actually all the European countries and Asian countries too. It's these trade agreements that we keep hearing about that basically will create a situation where corporations, obviously global corporations, will be in the best position to take advantage of this, who want to develop anything, let's say inside the United States, in any community that has any kind of law against their ability to develop it, will automatically be able to claim a loss of profits and sue whoever is stopping them from that development. This is how unreal the level of the loss of sovereignty is. And right now, the European countries, I think France and Germany in particular, are actually beginning to have huge local movements. They say that you know, there's like two-thirds of the German people are against the trade agreement being signed by Germany, which once again gives away sovereignty. So what you're seeing is really, you know, a breakdown of, you know, of the fundamental empowerment process that every American really believed America was about, which is your ability to make money and grow your family and basically move on with that. And the very fundamental ability to, you know, make enough money to live, you know, is now, you know, really in doubt. And then the sovereignty issue of the United States is putting another spin on it, because some of the rights of, let's say, a local state, you know, a state to be, to try to keep jobs local, creating certain restrictions on, you know, the imports or certain restrictions on how companies can function in their state will be challenged and easily won, because the process includes mediation and not a court, which means, and they basically, the mediators are basically pretty much assigned by the corporations. So they basically get the mediators who are already basically on the side of the corporations pretty much to basically look at the arguments, and once there is a decision, there is no appeal. So this whole situation is all part of what's playing out. So you've got so many issues that are swirling underneath the very foundation of people's existence. So the sense of something is wrong, you know, is really getting through. So this is where this election process becomes very interesting, especially, you know, if you look at the certainly Hillary Clinton and the challenge that she's been put under, because she clearly represents a very traditional pro, you know, clearly Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, like the military, neocons like the Kagans and others have all basically switched from the Republicans to Hillary, because they don't see in Trump the willingness to really, you know, push the regime change agenda and, you know, the sort of the use of the military as heavily as they believe Hillary Clinton would do for them. So this is all part of what we're seeing, is the, you know, these challenges to the very mainstream political process that has been very, very entwined with what I think Hudson was describing, the rentier class represented by the, you know, the Goldman Sachs and, you know, and the Wall Street connections to that, and that clearly is now being challenged by, I think, a lot of people who are waking up to it. But the question that many people, I think, are still asking is, you know, what happens the day after the election? What really is going to happen to that individual? Look what happened to Obama with all his promises. You know, it's ironic that Obama has apparently surpassed every single president in the United States in terms of being a war president. He has basically managed a total war. His 8 years will have been the longest standing war president in the history of the United States, apparently. So here is a man who came in on bringing, getting us out of wars and getting a lot of things resolved to bring back the American economy and a lot of that focus. And that, of course, is a big concern about what would happen the day after the election.
We're talking with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, award-winning journalists and authors. They're must-read books. I want you to buy them today and read them. You will not be sorry. If you really want to understand what's happening in the world, their must-read books are Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, which is finally being told, and Crossing Zero, the AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire. You know, you mentioned Hillary Clinton, and I will say, and I'm reading, my friend Tom Franks has a new book, Listen Liberal, which I'm about halfway through. It just came out, and he will be on a future edition of this program, and I'm looking forward to talking to him about it. But he writes about how the Democratic Leadership Council, under Clinton's leadership back in the 80s, made a very public, you know, it was not shy at all. It did not hold the cards close. They said, we're moving the Democratic Party to the right. We're going after the corporate cash. We will be the new party of Wall Street. And we saw this in the Clinton presidency, where he said behind closed doors, he told confidants, I am an Eisenhower Republican. He's not a Democrat. He abandoned the working class of this nation. He abandoned the middle class to embrace a more traditional conservatism as the GOP went off the rails and moved further and further to the right into its social conservatism. And so then we have the possible presidency of Hillary Clinton, which is arguably going to be even more conservative than her husband's. But what does that mean then, Paul, for all of those Americans who, like Liz says, they're waking up, they realize, you know what, something's really wrong with our economy. The rich are getting richer like never before. We've never had this kind of inequality in this country, even in the Gilded Age. And most Americans are working harder than they've ever worked, and yet they make no money, and they can't pay their bills. What does a Hillary Clinton presidency mean for those people?
Hillary has been pushed a little bit further to the so-called left by the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, which, you know, needless to say, is a good thing. At least there is some resistance to this overwhelming corporate takeover of everything. And I, when I say that, I mean it's really frightening what they're taking over. I mean, they, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 100 years ago, they didn't have DNA testing. They didn't have the kind of medical research that they have now. They didn't have the brain, the brain mapped out. They didn't have the DNA mapped out. They have all kinds of things right now. I mean, in Britain, they've been keeping DNA databases from the time of infancy of children to determine whether, you know, where they came from, what families they came from, how much crime can be calculated. They're doing studies on that. They've been doing studies like that on Britain, and I'm sure they're doing them covertly here or privately here. They're not doing it publicly in the United States. But at any rate, the fact is that this sort of thing has been going on for, you know, for a long time. And so we're now faced with a public awareness of the fact that I don't think the public is completely aware of how deep and how long-term this program has been in operation. And so I really think that, as I said, Bernie Sanders pushed the awareness a little bit to the left, and I don't think, we know some of the people in the Bernie Sanders crowd, and we know that they're not going to be pushed around when it comes to the convention. I remember the 1968 Democratic convention in Chicago with Mayor Daley sending the police force out. I think there are limits to the concept of protest. But the fact is that you've got to be able to work within the existing parties. In the Republican Party, I don't think there's any question what's going to happen there. But in the Democratic Party, there may still be a little bit of wiggle room in terms of being able to get some kind of representation. Overall, I don't think Hillary Clinton is going to deliver for the American people, because I don't think she is of the American people. I think she represents a very small aspect, especially the one percenters. She will not release the transcripts of the speeches that she gave for Goldman Sachs to Goldman Sachs executives about what her view of the future would be. And if you look at Goldman Sachs, from the very beginning, they have been hand in glove with these new Democrats in pushing this corporate agenda on the United States, and not just the United States, on the world. The TTIP, the TTP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
NAFTA, yep.
All this stuff is being pushed. That is all their agenda. I mean, it has been their agenda from day one, and that's what the New Democrats were all about. And even though their coalition dissolved years ago, the fact is that they have worked their way into the government, into the levers of power of government and the bureaucracy, and educated a whole new young class of individuals to work at various junctions in this, so that you really can't, they've completely compromised the political system to the point where you really can't get much done inside the political system at all.
Well, I would just like to add that, I always like to go back in history a little bit sometimes and bring up certain facts that may help people to realize the long-term process that really is connected to this. As you know, Coy, we go back specifically to the Carter administration and to the role that Zbigniew Brzezinski, his national security advisor, had in really in the background as the national security advisor, really manipulating the whole process that became eventually the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Well, that one event actually opened the floodgate for the entire neocon agenda to take over Washington directly. Okay, that was when the ability of the and it was started with Carter, where once the Soviets were drawn into Afghanistan, they then had the raison to constantly push for increasing the military budget, which then became the Reagan agenda, which then covered covered his two administrations, was basically continuing to spend higher and higher amounts on military spending, which many people have been led to believe, and this is all part of the economic underpinning issue that needs to be understood. Many people, as Hudson has said, people who study economics are basically become educated idiots. The basic truth is that military spending does not produce anything productive. There may be individuals who make their personal living on a salary. That's not the point. The point is they're not putting anything back into the economy, basically. It's going into building destroyers. It's going into building aircraft to use in wars. If they're not in a war, it just sits there. So this is really not productive. So this drains the economy. That's why in 1975, 76, after the Vietnam War, the whole push towards reinvesting in the American economy was really a priority. And the Soviet invasion gave them the reason not to have to do that.
And if you want that military, if you want
that legacy.
Yeah, and if you want those military products to be productive, you've got to stay in war. You've got to stay at war.
That's right. Yeah, but what it does is it only destroys. So you have basically, then you can claim your economy is rebuilding what you've destroyed. So, you can see how it's an insane
economy. I mean, you've seen,
economy.
I'm sure you've seen the newsreels of what they did after World War II with all those thousands and thousands of fighter planes and crushing the fighter planes as they were lined up, just bulldozing them one after the next, And that we had more than 100%. We had 110% employment during World War II. because people were, you know, people were working more than one job. They were working, you know, extremely long work weeks in order to produce those planes and those tanks and those jeeps that were never used. So the thing is that then you had the post-World War II basically surge because you had all this pent-up demand and nothing to buy with all that money that you had made working all those hours. So you went through the late 1940s into the 1950s. It wasn't until 1960 that actually production caught up with the demand of all the stuff that had been done during World War II. And then they coasted, the economy coasted until the early 1970s and the Nixon administration. And then when he took all the money that was being spent on Vietnam, all that pent-up demand was being spent on all this extra goods and services to go off to Vietnam, and the economy started to inflate. The dollar started to inflate, and that's when the Germans and the Japanese demanded. They said, "Hey, wait a minute! You're intentionally inflating the economy over there with this war of yours. You got to pay us back in gold." And Nixon says, "We're not paying you back in gold. We're paying you. I'll take the dollar. We'll take the dollar off the gold standard." So that's where we've been ever since 1972. And we had a few years of chaos with the oil crisis. I remember when oil was gasoline was at 28 cents a gallon in 1971. 1972, and it suddenly went to 45 cents a gallon, 48. Everybody went, "Oh my God, how am I going to pay for gasoline at 45 cents a gallon?" So, I mean, you know, here we are downstream now, you know, 40 years later, 45 years later, and we're looking at the end result of all these manipulations, all these shenanigans, all these financialized this and financialized that, and we really have come to the end of the stream. The question really is, what kind of real economy do we want? How are we going to get it? I think we have an opportunity here, Coy, to get some real democracy in this country. And the fact is that I think more people are aware at this point than unaware that the system is not working on their behalf and was never really intended to work on their behalf.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was something I probably mentioned to on your show before that George Ball, remember George Ball? He's back in the 1968. I think he was in the George Ball was the Kennedy administration, I believe, in the 1960s. And he went to a conference of world leaders in 1967, 1968, and said, what we need is a world government based on the lines, developed on the lines of the kind of East India Company model. The East India Company, of course, is what the Patriots in Boston Harbor threw the tea over the side of the ship about because they were being taxed by the British government. The British government was basically supporting the East India Company's adventures in all these places around the world, from India and Afghanistan to the American colonies. So, you know, this has been going on a long time. It's complex, and they intentionally developed an educational system that has blinded us to the real history, the economic, and Michael Hudson actually talks about the fact that you don't get the economic historians, people like John Galbraith and the people who studied and looked at and were there during a lot of the financial perturbations that happened in the 1930s and 40s and 1950s. And you don't get that. The students today don't get that memory, so they have an induced state of amnesia in terms of what had happened before, and with the amnesia, you don't get any kind of memory. You can't make conscious decisions about where we're headed today.
If you don't know what really happened, there is no way you can actually fix it.
That's why your show is so important. Your mission in life, Coy, is being fulfilled. I mean, really, you know, we've got to wake up, and it really is. We have a kind of, it's been referred to as the zombie economy. We do have a kind of zombie economy, but the fact is that people are waking up to the fact that these things are not working on their behalf, and we need to really change it.
Yeah. Go ahead, Liz. Go right ahead.
One of the things I just wanted to bring up at this very moment is because I really always want to make sure that we can bring something in that we feel is a very positive and very important way for people to look at what's happening now. We're really coming to the end of an experience, and the most important thing I feel for everybody to do is to really become incredibly educated about the complexity of what's happening. It's very easy to get upset and to really, you know, just lash out and or to be drawn in with a lot of, you know, why is this happening to me? It's kind of like we're a world of citizens. We're all kind of screaming that. Why is this happening to me? And at some level, I like to frame it this way. I think the ones who really have the problem are the one percenters, okay, and all their acolytes. I think they have a disease. The disease is money. The disease is having so much of it, they are sickened people. I think of them as kind of modern dinosaurs, you know. They're simply too filthy rich. And because they're filthy rich, they seem to have the ability to take more and more. But, you know, they claim, at least this is one of the theories, that the dinosaurs contributed to their own demise because nothing could interfere with the way in which they could interact with the natural world. They were too huge. So I think there's a reason.
So they wound up consuming everything.
Right, but I think there's a reason when they claim that this meteor hit the Earth and all the species were killed. 75% of the species came back, but not the dinosaurs. Now, I think we're kind of in a similar metaphor to that, where in our metaphor, though, the metaphor is economy. What is the largest personal economy any one person can have in comparison to the smallest personal economy anyone can have? And there is some equality between those two. In the world of Plato and Aristotle, the ratio was 1-7, I think, or 1-6 maybe, something like that. We're now in an economy that is so out of balance. The tiniest human economy now is something like 1 to probably 1 million. And there is no relationship. It's as if these super rich people are not humans like the average person is anymore. So we have to look at them as they're really the problem. They have a disease. And their disease makes them crazy.
Well, especially those superhuman,
very bad things.
Especially those superhuman corporate people, who never die. They live forever, and they're they're quote unquote citizens and real people as far as the government is concerned.
That's right. Yeah, and they pass on through philanthropy, they continue to control their wealth. That's one of the things that's very key. They take billions of dollars, like what Bill Gates is doing right now, and they make sure to infuse their viewpoint through that philanthropy, and then they set up a trust fund so that their ideas then get infused into the future. Cecil Rhodes was very good at that. That was one of his missions by creating the Rhodes Scholarship. That's a perfect way to basically influence all, like Bill Clinton, who was a Rhodes Scholar. These things, people have to begin to see the patterns and how these things happen, and it's not by accident.
What I am reminded of, one of Jefferson's efforts as a member of the Virginia legislature in the 1770s, and this was going on across throughout the new states after the war, is they were going after established wealth, and they were going after specifically the law of primogeniture, which allowed families to build up and concentrate wealth. You know, only the law basically said that the firstborn son got everything, that the father was not allowed by state law to spread his money around. All of the wealth had to be concentrated into that firstborn son, which is why the secondborn son went into the military to build his name and his brand in military pursuits. And the firstborn son just inherited the estate. That was the medieval structure. That was the medieval pattern that the Americans attacked. They attacked it outright. We want to end that. We want to break that up so that wealth is allowed to be spread around through a new economy as the capitalist economy was just coming into being out of that old mercantilist system.
So it was a liberation. Capitalism was seen as a liberation.
Yes, exactly.
The old rentier class, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what we're reverting now. Capitalism has been, when the United States deindustrialized, we lost that ability to create wealth and to buy one's own labor. The meritocracy kind of faded into the background, and a new kind of class was created, which was really an old kind of class, the one that Jefferson was railing against.
Yeah, yeah. And so, it was made possible by the historic, Tom Franks writes about this in his new book, the historic opposition to those efforts. Historically, the Democratic Party, the party of the people, of the working class, of the people who actually got out and worked for a living and didn't just push papers, didn't make money off of money. They made money with their own labor. that Democratic Party traditionally represented those people. But beginning with the beginning with Carter, certainly the DLC in the 80s, and we see it in full bloom with Clinton in the 90s, they walked away from that. They turned their backs on the middle class, on the working people of this country, and said, you're on your own. We're not going to represent you anymore. We're representing the new class of professionals, the Yale graduates, the Harvard graduates, the Clinton and his ilk and Obama and his ilk. That's who we're here to represent, the upwardly mobile upper middle class who want to be part of the 1%. We're going to help them do it.
Exactly. And I think my point, though, earlier about the class of people that we're talking about, the one percenters, the Clintons really would, to me, be described as the acolytes of that class, where they are they're wannabes. They're obviously, at this point, I think, 100 millionaires. They're not probably close to billionaires yet, but they're on their way. And they're already been seduced into thinking that they're one of them. And I think that's part of the sign of the disease, that this money, that, you know, there must be a reason why people who end up in that situation, and you're looking at Washington right now, and basically it's as if the entire city is basically filled with people who are seduced by the money. The most important thing that a senator and congressman has to deal with is raising money. That becomes the number one thing. And all the needs of the constituents is number two, number three, number four. So you can see that it really is very difficult for with the money being, and what the Supreme Court, of course, has done is they've allowed all kinds of ways for big money to get into that system at an even greater level than ever before.
Yeah, thank you, Citizens United. So we now live in an era in American history that we have never lived in before, where the political system that has become an economic system. And the capitalism, it's not even capitalism, but this economic system of the rentier society, rent-seeking economics, regulatory capture, it has subsumed the political system.
Exactly. And so the question comes now, what comes next? We can see that if given the opportunity and given the choice, the people who are leading this country, that rentier class, will continue to do what they're doing. And I said there's this strange kind of amnesia about what happened in the past. I mean, we've already been through this process. We went through the French Revolution. We went through the American Revolution, where this kind of class was thrown off the backs of the people. You know, we have never had more of an opportunity as individuals to process information, to develop new products, to become innovative and creative. And what is happening instead? We have got layer and layer of state bureaucracy in support of corporate bureaucracy that continues to stop anything and lock it up. You know, encoded, encrypted. You can't do this. You can't do that. We have more rules. We are a rule-based society, not a society of laws any longer. We're a society of rules, and if you infractions. I mean, I tell my son about when he was in high school about some of the stuff I used to do when I was in high school, and we just didn't even think about it. You know, and he said, "Oh, did you get permission from the principal to do that? Did you get the authority from the school committee to do?" I said, "Get the school committee to do what?" You know, when my older brothers and sisters, who were 12 and 15 years older than me, did even crazier stuff. They used to have a day called Crazy Day. You know, so what I'm saying is that, you know, bit by bit, generation by generation, the opportunities, the freedoms, the way the individual thinking has been narrowed and narrowed and narrowed into this kind of depersonalized, systematized, psychologized thinking, and it's really we've reached the dead end.
And that is why the technology is so dangerous, because what is happening is that people are being drawn into their technology to the point now where they have to create a law that basically stops people from texting while they drive, because people are addicted to it. They really can't stop. And the only way they can stop it, it's like they, apparently texting is now more serious problem than drunk driving.
Oh, yeah,
well,
I believe
in the
it.
Meantime, in the meantime, Coy, I mean, in Massachusetts here, we have a dual opioid crisis going on. We have not just illegal heroin on the market, but we have also prescription drugs. And it's a, it is literally recognized by the state as a crisis, the over prescription of opioid based painkillers. And so we have that as a crisis. They said, you know, there was an article in the Boston Globe a couple of months ago about Harvard Square with Harvard University right opposite. And, you know, they had to close the public bathrooms in Harvard Square because too many people were choosing them to overdose in. You know, the restaurant bathrooms, things like that. This is what's going on in our society. It's happening all around, in addition to the collapsing infrastructure, in addition to the corroded and collapsing bridges, to the potholes in the roads here, and even in the mild winter. So, I mean, we've got everything is just kind of coming apart at the seams, and what do we have? We have the Bath Iron Works putting out a brand new Zumwalt class destroyer at $4.4 billion apiece. There were supposed to be 32 of them originally when they began the program 15 years ago. They can now only afford three of them because they're so expensive. I love the way they put it in the paper. The loss of economics of scale drove up the cost of the individual ships. That was the way they explained why they can only build three of these things instead of 33 of them. So, I mean, you know, what can I say about what needs to be done? I think Liz hit it right on the nose. I think education. We really need to educate young people. We need to educate the middle class, certainly. What's left of the middle class, certainly, is aware of what's being done to them. But they need tools by which they can be effective politically. And the political system, as you pointed out, has been stolen. And it's been stolen by the Democratic Party. It was stolen by Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, who brought in this whole group of people who said, we don't want to be Democrats, traditional Democrats, any longer. We want to be Republicans.
And now they're stealing the election, totally.
Yeah. You know, so who are we really going to have to vote for come November? I mean, that's what the crisis really becomes. And everyone knows that if Donald Trump is elected president, it will mean there are going to be some very, very severe changes to the way things are done. I mean, I don't think some of the things he's recommending in terms of foreign policy are bad. I think they're quite good. I think he's really talking about pulling back from the overreach that the United States has had with the hundreds and hundreds of military bases and this global police role and involving ourselves in the South China Sea against China and in Ukraine and these other places. This is completely unnecessary.
But there's another side to Trump.
But there's another
very
side to
problematic.
Trump.
Yeah, there's the demagogue side as well, yeah. Yeah, but it's good to point out that he's not the Taft 1930s isolationist that the Democrats are trying to make him out to be. He is sensible in that regard, but he's completely frightening and a demagogue in many other regards.
Absolutely, absolutely. Exactly. And that's part of it, that we really have no really, I think, ideal solution to this crisis in leadership, and that's what I'm trying to explain, that anybody who even gets close to it is partly drawn into it. It's very difficult not to be affected by it.
Yeah. And this is, as you both point out so wisely, this history tells us again and again and again that this is where revolutions come from. And it is not a matter of if, but when.
And we are, and that's one of the reasons why we're working with our Afghan partners on a conference for this October to really try to reframe and reclaim and reframe a new kind of idea about how to solve the problem. In our case, we're focusing on the Afghan problem, and we're working from a position that it really has been, for certainly the last 15 years, it has been a complete failure of American foreign policy. And the continuation of that policy, as represented certainly by Hillary Clinton at this point, we can see, you know, it, at some level, it doesn't matter who's elected. There's still going to be problems. But we can see that in some ways, certain potential, we have to be prepared for clear understanding of why we failed in the first place in order to really educate. At this point, we have to educate the people that are actually in the leadership position.
Yeah, yeah. The books are Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, and Crossing Zero, the AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire. Award-winning journalists and authors Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, my friends, we will talk again very soon. Thank you to you both, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
You too, Corey. Thank you.
Great.
You've been listening to Inside Charlottesville right here on WPVC 94.7, right here in Charlottesville, Virginia. I hope you have a terrific night.